This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Hope for the planet. Please vote for me, Susan Young, and please vote in this board election. It's important.
This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Valensky.
I'm Deborah Bell.
J.D. Doyle.
Glenn Holt.
Elisar Saliba.
And on tonight's show, we're going to have an interview, J.D. and Deborah. What's going on?
We're interviewing Trick Fury, one of the pillars of the women's music community.
Okay. Is that going to be a live interview or over the phone?
Over the phone.
Over the phone, okay. We are working on This Way Out because it wasn't... It's sort of a long story and a technical thing that we could probably spend the whole show but be real boring about talking about how we get the show. But we've got a couple of announcements. Of course, today was the first day of early voting.
And there are a number of locations around the city to go vote. Probably one of the most popular ones is the Multipurpose Center on West Gray.
At least for the inner city.
That's where I voted today.
Yeah, and also near me over by the Astrodome is the Fiesta store. I can early vote there. So it's, and almost any county annex.
The best thing to go is harrisvotes.org.
Harrisvotes.org.
Or go to the hglbtpc.org site, and there's lots of links to where to go.
For early voting.
For early voting.
And not only are there links, there's also the endorsements from the political action committee.
So right.
Now, there are some races where the caucus did not endorse.
Yes.
And there's also races where there are no opponents.
Correct.
So you vote your conscience on that one. I'm sure we each have an opinion on...
Yes.
That is not necessarily the opinion of KPFT or, other people that...
But early voting is from 8 to 4:30 this Monday through Friday. On Saturday, it's from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Sunday, it's 1 to 6 p.m. And then next week, Monday through Friday, it's 7 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Wow.
So, which is really neat that you have this opportunity to go vote before regular election day, because you never know what's going to happen.
And you can take a little bit of extra time that way, for one thing. And you can do it fairly convenient, because maybe where your office is closer to one of those early voting locations than trying to work it in during the day
right.
of election day.
Right, and if you're a registered voter in Harris County, you can vote at any one of those places, which is really neat, because they have the computer and they can look you up. Now, I voted about 11 a.m., and there actually was a little bit of a line there, which is good, and maybe that means that they want to throw some of those people out and vote new people in, which would be good.
And besides the candidates, there's also, what are they called? Are they referendum, or are they amendments?
Yes.
What are they called?
They are, what are they
special
called?
Special
propositions.
Propositions. I've been propositioned before.
You have?
Yes.
Or after, too.
And I said, yeah. No, propositions of concerning the city finances, they're really important. And
a number of those.
Yes.
There's A to G.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
And the caucus recommends you voting for all of them.
There you go.
So
we can only speak...
Was that on the card?
That is on the card. Actually, it's A to H.
You have an office with the caucus. What is it?
I am on the board.
Board member.
And
so
our friend Jennifer is president.
That's right.
Until then, we're doing a number of things like block walking, that's knocking on people's doors and reminding them to vote. We're also doing phone banking. Block walking is Tuesdays from 6 on and Saturdays from 10 a.m. You show up at the community center, which is at 3400 Montrose. Phone banking is Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. and Saturday, 10 to 4. And then we're also going to sort of have a sort of mini unofficial rally on Saturday at the Metropolitan Multi-Service Center.
We are?
Yes.
Oh, all right.
Yes. To urge people to sort of cheerlead them about voting. And if you need a list of the endorsed candidates by the caucus, you go to hglbtpc.org. Women'sVote.org, and it's all listed there. So, besides early voting, the Women's Festival was Saturday. How did that go?
Very nice.
Well, J.D. and I were both there with several hundreds of our friends. Deidre McCullough, who is another icon in the women's music, was there, and I hadn't seen her in about 13 years. And
I'd never had the chance to see her. She was wonderful.
Yeah,
a voice, and you just pour honey over it, and just wonderful, wonderful.
And, of course, Patrice Pike from Austin, Texas, who has had recent fame as being one of the contestants on Rockstar Supernova. And at one time they told her that she was better as a solo performer than a front for a band. And, you know, I think she's a lot. People are going to hear a lot more from Patrice Pike. That was kind of exciting.
Well, but speaking of music,
I ate lots of, you know, good junk food, you know, things on a stick.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
And of course, we had people out there pushing the political things,
and they had some arts and craftsy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you know, it was nice.
And the weather held out.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I had to work on it. Gave myself a headache, but I managed for it to clear up and be a lovely day.
Well, speaking of music.
Well, I want to play a song by Trev Fury, our guest. But before we get into that, I want to tell you who she is, because there may be, you know, a few people who aren't familiar with her. I think she's one of the major contributors to our, you know, women's music culture, and she goes back quite a while. Her first album was in 1973. And the way I figure it out, she's had about 6 solo releases and 3 releases with Chris Williamson. And she's produced, engineered, played, and sang on at least 20 other releases. So I want to play, to start off, a song from her latest CD, Anytime, Anywhere, a very political song called The Eyes of God.
And I thank God. were signs on every street. Like how she always turned away and their eyes would never meet. And how she cut him to the quick if he ever criticized. But somewhere deep down, Curtis knew that she could see it in his eyes. Little love dies hard for those who live in some forgotten story. But for Curtis, it was more than
this is J.D., and in a moment of complete disclosure, I requested the wrong song from the engineer. I wanted to play The Eyes of God, and we got End of Glory. You know, E.G., E.G., kind of similar, you know, but nice song, just the same. Tret, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, well.
I was going, that's not Eyes of God.
I knew it after the first minute or so.
Yeah, right.
Your latest album, Anytime, Anywhere, I meant to play Eyes of God, one of your more political songs. How's it been received?
Oh, very well. It gets a lot of airplay. You know, I actually tried to get it on Air America as much as I could, and I haven't had much success yet, because I think the song really speaks particularly to this administration and to the president who seems to think he is, you know, does have the hand of God on his side. So it's a very powerful song, and people respond amazingly to it, and it does get a fair amount of play, which is good. Just really good. I don't write a lot of political songs, but the ones I do, they're really important to me.
Well, the one I chose to end our segment a few minutes from now is Hawk and the Dove.
Yes.
Another very political song. That one's
that's the one I wrote right after 9/11. In fact, right. I wrote it on 9/12/01.
That's from your prior album, My Shoes.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But tell me just a comment or two about your latest album.
Well, I think it's my best work to date. I think, you know, it's...
You know, I've never had an artist say, this album isn't as good as my last album.
This is just terrible. I mean, every artist hopes that they're continually growing and maturing, and I do believe that I am. I mean, people ask me what's my best work, and I am torn between Anytime, Anywhere and My Shoes, because I think they stand equally. But there is a bit of maturity, a little more maturity, I think, to Anytime, Anywhere. And, you know, as a growing artist, that's what you hope for. And there's a great variety to this CD, I think, more than the last three CDs I've done solo, Back Home, My Shoes, and Anytime, Anywhere. I think the most variety is established on Anytime, Anywhere.
Well, I think the lyrics are, I guess, wiser?
I hope so. I think so, yes.
From a little more, I hate to say seasoned perspective?
Well, it's seasoned, you know. I mean, the title song itself is about being over 50 and not being dead. Still, you know, still having it. So, there, you know, I do speak more on the issues of aging and aging well, and like a good
wine.
I think
that's great. How much touring do you do?
After the last, God knows how many years, I've been doing about 100 shows a year, and this year I cut back to about 50, because I really, it's really hard being out on the road as much as I have been, and I'm now traveling solo. My partner was traveling with me for the last 5 years, and she's back working, she's a hospital administrator, and I have the opportunity to not work as much if I don't want to, and I've chosen to cut back so that I can write more, so I can actually be home, and so I can stay healthy, and because the road is it's weary.
And you're based out of where?
I'm based out of Madison, Wisconsin.
So kind of like if you tour, you have to go ways to tour.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's actually easier than when I was on the West Coast. I was on the West Coast for 30 years. And when you tour, you have to fly a long way, at least from the Midwest. I can do a lot of my touring by car. And when I fly to the East Coast, it's a short flight. It's only when I go west that it's longer. But I'm trying to gauge, I'm trying to work it so that I'm only doing two weekends a month, six shows a month. And if I can do that, I mean, I'd still be doing over 70 shows, but it wouldn't be every month. But that's my goal, because I love my work, but I also love being home. I have a very wonderful home life, and I'm looking to enjoy it.
I know the older I get, the more I want to stay home.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is, you know, I think it's the nature of the business, too. I mean, people want to stay home more, and that's why live art is in jeopardy as well. Because not just, you know, people who work on the road want to stay home, but people who just are live in their own towns, when they get home from a long day at work, they want to stay home. And that's tough for touring musicians as well.
What song of yours gets the most audience reaction?
Probably Anytime, Anywhere. At least in the women's community,
uh-huh.
You know, and for my over 50 crowd, that song gets a rousing response. But also, I'd have to say, My Shoes has been a very powerful song for not just women, for men and women, because it's a song that speaks about being judged. I left a 19-year relationship, and the song basically says no one has a right to judge your life, mm-hmm. until you've walked a mile in your shoes. And this song has been used in divorce therapy. It's been used in many different scenarios, and it really has been a source of power.
Kind of an answer to the people who, you know, knew about your very public relationship with Chris and say, and just wonder.
Yeah. And it is. And it was something I felt like I had to say, and it's been healing, mm-hmm. for me and certain parts of my audience, but it's also very healing for people who have been where I've been. And God, almost everybody has.
Yeah,
you know,
it says it very well.
Many people have had to leave at some point a relationship.
I love it.
You know, there's not a lot of songs written from that perspective of the person who leaves. And I think it's been an important song in my career.
Well, the wedding song I like a lot, too.
Oh, that's the other one, yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how many people ask me to sing that. I've become the wedding singer. People are trying to get me to come and sing at all their weddings and ceremonies, and that song gets used a lot in commitment ceremonies, and I have been asked to come and sing that more times than I can say. But I think that's a good song. Very.
Deborah Bell, and speaking of weddings, we had a women's festival this weekend on Saturday, and two of the people there, Leslie and Sherry, said that they were in line in front of you on the day you got married to Jane.
Oh, great. I remember those women, yeah.
Yes. I'm thinking, small world.
Yeah, absolutely. All the way up to Portland, Oregon. Yeah.
So yeah. You're coming to Houston on November 4th.
Correct.
And where else are you going to be going on this trip?
That weekend, I start in Fort Worth. I'm playing for the Open Door Productions, women I've worked with for a long time, at the UU Church in Fort Worth. And then I come to Houston. And then on Sunday, I'm playing a house concert in Richardson that I've played before.
So you're Dialecti's the host of that.
Pardon me?
I know Diane, who's the host of the...
Oh, yeah, Diane.
She was at the festival this weekend.
Yeah, she's great.
It seems like that there's a little bit of a resurgence of what is known as women's music. Do you feel that's true?
Well, I think in the sense that there are a lot more women out there doing music, and I think a lot of the much younger women are saluting the work that the older women have done, and in the sense there are younger artists out there now who are doing very political work that they consider women-based, and I find that heartening, because I think it was about to go under the term itself, women's music. But, you know, I think a lot of these younger artists, I mean, artists that I admire, like Ember Swift and Alex Olsen and
Camelines,
you know, they really salute the women who have come before, and that's it's encouraging, it's heartening. But I also think that because of the way that music is, I mean, women that have now been, are so much part of the mainstream, it's almost like there's not as much need for the niche of women's music. And in that sense, it is in jeopardy, but and that's also regional. I mean, there's areas. I mean, the Houston Women's Music Festival is a hot item, and that's great.
Well, Deidre McCullough was there. We're going to have Ann Reed the weekend after you're here. So, a lot of the pioneers, such as yourself, are still out there on the road and still making the music, writing the music, and collaborating with other artists. So I'm loving it. I'm loving it. And I think it's great for some of the younger women to be exposed to this, to realize.
I totally agree with you on that.
And then, of course, JD does such an incredible job with his website, Queer Music Heritage, and the music he presents on this show and Queer Voices and through This Way Out, that is archiving our history with the music and at the times, the things that were going on during the time that that music was created in our community. So
I find that the interviews capture the music, but they also capture a history of the culture.
Exactly. You said it so much better than I did.
Is that what you were going to say?
That's what I was trying to say.
Trent promised me an interview when she's in town, so I'm going to have another feature for QMH coming up on that.
Absolutely. I'm excited about that.
More in depth. Let me give some of the specifics about the concert here in Houston. It's Diva House Concerts, which I'm one of the producers. It's November 4th at Super Happy Funland, and that's at 2610 Ashland Street at 27th Street in the Heights, and you can order tickets by sending me an email at thedivadev@yahoo.com. That's THED as in Diva, IVA, D as in Deb, EB@yahoo.com. And you can also make checks out payable to Loaf, speaking to those older women, Arden Eversmeyer, who is one of the real incredible older women, is very happy that you're coming to Houston and is telling everybody.
Great.
So,
what does Loaf stand for?
That's the Lesbians Over Age 50.
Oh, good.
The tickets can also be picked up on November 4th at the Lesbian Health Initiative Health Fair at Montrose Clinic, or on Sunday mornings at the Women's Group at the First Unitarian Church. And just let me tell you, if you want to know more about Trett, you can go to her website at www.trettfury, and that's spelled TRETFURE.com.
Mm-hmm.
And they can also go to the www.superhappyfunland.com to find out directions and all of that. I can also be called at 832-452-1169. And that is Diva House Concerts presenting Trett Fury on November the 4th. And we're really looking forward to it. I'm going to let J.D. Ask more questions because he's so good at it.
I've got a wrap-up question, I guess. One of my older favorites of yours is Tomboy Girl.
Uh-huh.
And you've made kind of your own cottage industry out of that. Tell us about that. I have.
It started as a song. It became a T-shirt, then a hat, and now it's an entire line of clothing. I have a retail store in Madison. I have a website, and I always bring lots of clothing to my shows. And it's just something that has really caught on for all of us who've grown up as tomboys and own that word.
I love them.
Well, I have the I Love My Tomboy Girls shirt, too.
Oh, okay.
But it's interesting because, you know, in my store in Madison, most of my customers are middle school girls, and they love the term because to them it's empowering. So, you know, I have a whole cross-section. I have really girly stuff for the young girls, and then I have T-shirts and sweatshirts and hats for my live audience, and a whole array of stuff on my website for anyone who loves the label. So, you know, it was really my partner's brainstorm, but between the two of us, we've managed to maintain a really strong business through that song, Tomboy Girl.
Well, we're looking forward to your visit. I know I certainly am. What's that date again, Deborah?
November the 4th.
You can contact?
Just before the scary elections.
Right.
And right after scary Halloween.
We're going to go out with a song from My Shoes called Hawk and the Dove, the other political song I talked about. And we thank you for joining us on Queer Voices, Trent.
Thank you so much, J.D. I appreciate it. And Deborah, thank you.
your voices. I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 21st, 2006. U.S. Roman Catholic bishops announced this week that they're developing new guidelines for ministry to homosexuals while reaffirming church opposition to same-gender marriage and adoption by lesbians and gay men. The draft document encourages parishes to make gays and lesbians feel welcome and provide them pastoral support, claiming that many are ardently striving to live their faith within the Catholic community so as not to fall into the lifestyle and values of a gay subculture. The proposed guidelines in development since 2002 may be amended, but a final vote on them will be held at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting in mid-November in Baltimore, Maryland. While condemning discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, the draft document reaffirms the Catholic view of homosexual attraction as disordered, and that same-gender relationships violate the true purpose of sexuality, as do adultery and contraception. Catholic teaching is based on objective moral norms, not prejudice, the authors claim, and gays and lesbians should learn to live chastely and celibately. The document reportedly also says that Catholics should be denied Holy Communion if they lack adherence to what the Church authoritatively teaches on matters of faith and morals. Matt Foreman, executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, wrote that much of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered community is working to protect our families, to be protected from discrimination and violence, and to have the freedom to serve in the U.S. military. So much for the immoral lifestyles we are supposedly creating.
The Roman Catholic priest, named by disgraced Republican Congressman Mark Foley as having sexually abused him as a teenager, spoke with reporters this week. From his home on the Mediterranean island of Gozo in Malta, now 72-year-old Anthony Mersica talked about the intimate two-year relationship he had with Foley when the former congressman was a teenage altar boy living in Lake Worth, Florida. He described activities that he says now might be perceived as sexually inappropriate, but called his relationship with Foley innocent. Among those activities, massaging Foley while the boy was naked, skinny dipping together at a secluded lake, and being naked in the same room on overnight trips. Foley family sources, who requested anonymity, told reporters that the two did have one sexual encounter that took place when Foley was 12 or 13. The priest told reporters that he may have been going through a nervous breakdown at the time, which he said affected my mind a little bit. Experts say that a refusal to accept responsibility for their actions is typical of many sexually abusive priests. Mersica said he doesn't understand why Foley has decided to come forward after almost 40 years, wondering if he was looking for a scapegoat. Why does he want to destroy me in my old age, he asked. According to a website for the Diocese of Gozo, Mersica is still listed as one of its active priests. Meanwhile, the U.S. House Ethics Committee continues to hear closed-door testimony about the Foley scandal amid conflicting statements from Republican leadership officials about who knew what and when they knew it.
As we reported last week, former Democratic U.S. Representative Gary Studs of Massachusetts, the first openly gay member of Congress, died on October 14th at the age of 69. In 2004, he married longtime partner Dean Hara after same-gender marriage was legalized in their state. But unlike the legal spouses of other members of Congress who've died, Hara won't be receiving any portion of Studs' annual federal pension, which in this case would be about $62,000, because the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act blocks the U.S. government from recognizing their marriage. Under federal law, pensions can otherwise only be denied to those convicted of espionage or treason. Hara has thus far declined public comment on the pension issue. The National Taxpayers Union, a nonprofit citizen watchdog group, noted that U.S. Congressman Bob Ney, the Ohio Republican who pled guilty last week to conspiracy charges and faces up to 10 years behind bars for taking bribes from disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff, will still receive his congressional pension for the rest of his life, even while he's in prison.
Two British lesbians have abandoned their battle to force the United Kingdom to recognize their Canadian marriage. In July, the High Court Family Division upheld a UK law that automatically converted Sue Wilkinson and Celia Kitzinger's Canadian marriage into a civil partnership, as it does for all legal same-gender marriages conducted in other countries. The court also slammed the couple with the equivalent of more than $46,000 in court costs. Wilkinson and Kitzinger say that's close to their life savings and that they have no money to appeal the decision. This financial penalty is clearly intended to deter us from seeking justice, they wrote in an email. We will campaign in other ways instead.
Ireland's High Court reserved judgment last week in a lawsuit filed by another lesbian couple married in Canada who seek to have their legal union recognized. Dr. Catherine Zapponi and Dr. Anne Louise Gilligan want Ireland to recognize their Canadian marriage or give them the right to marry there. High Court Justice Elizabeth Dunn didn't indicate when she would issue her decision.
Meanwhile, the European Commission has funded a two-year project called Family Matters, supporting families to prevent violence against gay and lesbian youth. It will be run by the Department of Social Research at Italy's University of East Piedmont and by groups for parents, families, and friends of gays and lesbians in Italy, Spain, and the United Kingdom. The money will be spent on polling, on identifying public and social service sector good practice for families of homosexual young people, and to produce educational material, a documentary video, and a website. The commission said lesbian and gay youth frequently lack support and role models, and that families of gays and lesbians need help to accept their children and assist them in dealing with self-esteem, bullying, and discrimination.
Hong Kong's government this week decided not to appeal a judicial ruling against its unequal age of consent law. While it still requires formal legislation, the move effectively lowers the homosexual age of consent in China's special administrative region from 21 to 16. In his ruling that the unequal law governing the age of consent for homosexual relations was unconstitutional, Chief High Court Judge Jeffrey Ma wrote that no evidence has been placed before us to explain why the minimum age requirement for buggery is 21, whereas as far as sexual intercourse between a man and a woman is concerned, the age of consent is only 16. In a brief statement, Hong Kong Security Bureau said it would not challenge the court's decision, saying only that, after considering all the relevant factors, the government decided not to appeal the judicial review.
Lesbian and gay Iranians seeking asylum in the Netherlands will now be granted full resident status, according to an announcement this week by Dutch Immigration Minister Rita Verdonk. She had declared her intention earlier this year to end a moratorium on deportation of lesbi-gay Iranians, saying that they could not claim possible persecution if they were returned to their home country. For homosexual men and women in Iran, she said, it is not totally impossible to function in society, although they should be wary of coming out of the closet too openly. But after strong protests from Dutch and international human rights organizations, Verdonk reinstated the deportation ban for 6 months, pending a review of conditions in Iran. While there has been some disagreement among global human rights groups about whether or not the death penalty for homosexuality is being implemented in Iran, Verdonk said her decision this week was based primarily on new reports by Human Rights Watch. That group noted that Iran's Sharia Penal Code, the Code of Islamic Punishments, calls for the death penalty for homosexual male intercourse. Non-penetrative sex between men, the group says, is punishable by 100 lashes for the first three convictions and execution the fourth time. In addition, men who are not related by blood and lie naked under the same cover without any necessity can be punished with 99 lashes. Sex between women is punishable by 100 lashes for the first two convictions and execution the third time. Human Rights Watch said this month that the government of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has tightened restrictions on civil society and increased punishments for dissent in recent months, including death sentences for so-called morals offenses.
But the Office of Turkey's Public Prosecutor has dismissed an attempt by the governor of Bursa to shut down that province's transgender and gay rights group, Gurkasaki Dernegi, or Rainbow Association. Members of the group were forced to retreat inside their meeting place earlier this year after religious zealots and football hooligans attacked them as they attempted to hold a first-ever pride march. The governor's office had claimed the group's existence violated laws that ban organizations that promote activities that are illegal or offend public morality. In its determination, the prosecutor's office wrote that homosexuality is not an offense and that the Rainbow Association exists to reach accord with society and defend their rights while explaining their identity. The ruling concluded that the group had not acted with a deliberate intention of offense.
And finally, rock star Melissa Etheridge and her spouse Tammy Lynn Michaels have announced the arrival of twins, Miller Stephen, a boy, and Johnny Rose, a girl. They were welcomed into the world by Melissa and birth mother Tammy on October 17th. Michaels and the twins are all reported to be doing well. According to a statement on Melissa's website, "The creation of life brings about immeasurable love and pours hope into the future. The joy will help carry us through our upcoming sleepless nights."
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 21st, 2006. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya King Perry.
And I'm John Beaupre.
I'm Dr. Robert Simmons, Jr. of Lebanon, Ohio, a longtime This Way Out listener and donor. In memory of my mother, Mabel Simmons, I'm issuing a matching challenge to supporters of this volunteer-driven nonprofit operation. Please visit thiswayout.org to see how your help to keep this program on the air will now be worth twice as much. You'll also get a tax deduction if you're in the United States, and you'll find some unique holiday gifts there too. Again, please log on to thiswayout.org. We'll all be very thankful.
She conquered sleeping sickness. He observed sickness of another kind. You'll hear about a scientist and a celebrity later in the program. But first, This Way Out correspondent Janet Mason gets passionate about a leading lesbian author's latest effort.
In Wait, The Myth of Atlas and Heracles by Jeanette Winterson, published by Canongate. Winterson revisits and reinvents the myth of Atlas with the express purpose of wanting to tell the story again. She explains that as a fiction writer, she has the freedom to retell the same story, the stories we think we know, and record them differently. Perhaps all artists are a little compulsive. Obsessive. I understand the need to tell the story again, the revisiting of old mysteries, the attempt to make sense of the nonsensical. The writing of this review is a retelling of the story. But first, I want to retell the story of Jeanette Winterson in a nutshell. In a chance encounter with a friend before a reading that Jeanette was giving, the friend gasped, "I read everything and loved it, particularly The Passion." This kind of audible response is rare enough to be delightful, and it yet is not uncommon among Jeanette Winterson's followers in what is loosely known as the lesbian community. This author of Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, Sexing the Cherry, Written on the Body, and The Power Book, just to name a few, is the bad girl extraordinaire of her native British tabloids, as she woos away men's wives and responds rudely to criticism. But it's not her persona that causes the audible response. It is her brilliance on the page. Winterson begins her first-person odyssey as Atlas with a statement that the free man never thinks of escape. And thus begins the tale of Atlas trapped in his life, longing for freedom, and Jeanette just as trapped with what she calls her monsters. And the two of them thinking their way through to an open door where Atlas can lay down his burden and Jeanette can walk away from the weight of the world. She presents the reader with a cosmology of the universe as it exists around and inside of each one of us. What is it that you contain, the dead, time, light patterns of millennia opening up in your gut? Every minute in each of you, a few million potassium atoms succumb to radioactive decay. The energy that powers these tiny atomic events has been locked inside potassium atoms ever since a star-sized bomb exploded into being. Potassium, like uranium and radium, is a long-lived radioactive nuclear waste of the supernova bang that accounts for you. Your first parent was a star. Along the way, we see the heroics and the flaws of those who live on Mount Olympus, and we are privileged to witness their mundane daily lives. Atlas holding up the world for all eternity, Prometheus having his liver torn out day after day, the endless bickering of Hera and Zeus in an arrangement called marriage. As myths go, this one really is no different. It is full of deceit, betrayal, and courage. It tells the story of how others have lived and do live their lives so that we can have more insight into our own. Ultimately, Winterson breathes new life into an old story, or perhaps it is the story, and her chosen persona of Atlas that lends new meaning to her as a writer, retelling her own story, unraveling her own intricacies. Winterson, as story retailer, explains that every body of knowledge is incomplete. If only I understood that the globe itself, complete, perfect, unique, is a story. Science is a story. History is a story. These are the stories we tell ourselves to make ourselves come true. This is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
Dr. Louise Pierce, renowned woman scientist of her time, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Louise Pierce was born in Massachusetts in 1885 and was one of the first women to earn a degree in physiology. She earned her medical degree from Johns Hopkins 5 years later. Pierce was one of the leading women scientists of the early 20th century. She traveled to the Belgian Congo with drugs she'd helped develop to treat African sleeping sickness. She tested it on 70 patients with miraculous results. The drug eradicated the parasitic disease within weeks, eliminating symptoms and restoring general health in even extreme cases, curing over 100,000 Africans. Belgian officials awarded her the Ancient Order of the Crown of Belgium. Pierce spent her last years in New Jersey sharing a home with Arthur Ida, A.R. Wiley, and noted New York City health physician Josephine Baker. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mary Gay Hutchison.
This is Dorothy Allison, author of Bastard Out of Carolina and numerous trashy pieces. You're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Queer.
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 Last year, critics, audiences, and Academy voters went wild for Capote, a film about the groundbreaking author as he wrote his classic In Cold Blood. Now Infamous, a film shot at roughly the same time and covering roughly the same period in Truman Capote's life, is lighting up movie screens to similar acclaim. This Way Out, Steve Pride probed the filmmaker and stars of Infamous to find out what it was about this diminutive gay man that made one small part of his story big enough for two great movies.
During his research for his book In Cold Blood, an account of the murder of a Kansas family, the writer Truman Capote developed a close relationship with Perry Smith, one of the killers. This period was the basis of last year's Oscar-nominated film, Capote. When word got around that another film covering the same ground was in the works, there was a bit of snickering. But the film Infamous is nothing to laugh at, although it has the humor that was sorely missing in the earlier film. It also captures the charm and bravery of a tiny gay man who is flamboyantly out in 1959.
What I love about our story is that it starts as a light comedy and ends as something very dark, with him in a very, very different place.
The writer and director of Infamous, Douglas McGrath.
Essentially, the bulk of the movie covers a period of about 6 to 8 months. There's a passage of a few years by the end, but essentially it covers a very small period, and yet I think it tells both the triumph and the tragedy of his life in that period.
Jimmy, yeah, will you confirm that there is more than one killer?
I will not.
Well, of course there was more than one, unless the killer was a hypnotist.
Beg your pardon, ma'am?
It's illogical to suppose there's only one killer. The Clutters were tied up. To tie them up, he'd have to put his gun down. Once he put the gun down, the Clutters would run for the hills.
I don't believe I know who you are.
Or what?
I'm from out of town.
What's your paper?
Ladies' Home Journal.
Oh, I'm not a reporter. I'm a writer.
English actor Toby Jones is almost a double for Truman Capote, and he gives us a man a great deal more fun and likable than we expected. But what were his personal feelings about the man he played?
Do I like Truman Capote? It seems such a simple question, but it isn't really a simple question because, in a sense, we can see Capote's life as a series of events now, and I can explore his life from a certain amount of events, but I don't actually have to meet the guy in the present moment. I see his life in terms of a whole history. So although it's a simple question, I'd say yes, I do like Capote, but that's because I know a lot about his life now, and I could, but if I was to meet him, would I like him? I don't know if I would.
And does he think that Truman Capote's flamboyance was a form of bravery?
For a long time, I was just trying to understand this persona that Capote created, the combination of the glasses, the very careful stylized hair, and, you know, the voice. And for an English person not very versed in Capote, it's an extraordinary impact. And it's not hard to imagine the impact he would have had in Kansas. And for a long time, I thought long and hard about this courage that he showed. But it's also a certain level of arrogance as well, that he feels so powerful, that this mask that he wears gives him such a sense of empowerment that he feels he can walk in anywhere. And people talk about other times when Mailer talks about him going to a bar, an Irish navvy bar, with Capote in a gabardine cape. And people talk about the impact of the Capote shell, as it were. Now, in a way, that sort of functions, I think, in a way that I think camp functions as a sort of, it's both a strategy for short-circuiting aggression and playing with aggression and also defending yourself from aggression. But as you say, it's all proto-gay culture. It's all sort of self-discovered strategies for dealing with a hostile world, in a way.
What about Terry?
It's Perry. Oh. As in Antoinette? He's an enigma. You know, before he killed the Cutter Boy, he put a pillow under his head, and he wouldn't let Dick rape the girl.
He's not all kind.
Jack's right. After these demonstrations of gentility, he did shoot them dead.
And cut the old man's throat.
So there's something, I can't quite put my finger on it. It seems insane to say that he's tender, but he does have the tender and the terrible side by side inside him.
I think Doug's pretty clear that he fell in love with him. In the Plimpton book, there's speculation about the nature of their relationship, and, you know, there's what I think is rather wild speculation that they could have had sex, which seems to me highly implausible. In our film, there is a level of intimacy reached that I think is, if it's not love, then it's certainly a kind of confusion that might become love. As a sort of giddiness. I think that Capote recognizes in Perry Smith so much unfulfilled potential that he, as a writer, was able to fulfill for himself, that he'd achieved, and he was in the business of achieving a certain level of self-fulfillment. And I think almost a twinning goes on, and a certain degree of sympathy goes on with Perry Smith that leads to a level of intimacy. You know, he's able to get inside Perry Smith's head.
Sandra Bullock plays Harper Lee, who is the author of To Kill a Mockingbird and a lifelong friend of Truman Capote. Catherine Keener received an Oscar nomination for playing the same role in that other Truman Capote film. While Bullock's performance is astounding, perhaps even career-defining, it's impossible to not make comparisons between the two films. I ask Bullock why someone who has already seen Capote should now see Infamous.
Different point of view. The writing, the performances, the humanity, the humor in it. Truman Capote was a funny little guy. He was perverted. He was smart. He was sharp. He would take you down. He was evil. He was brilliant, you know, and he was complicated, and he was a damaged, damaged child. And he always remained a damaged, damaged child. I think the character study is just brilliant, you know. Look at what Doug wrote and look at what Toby executed, and it's another way of looking at the whole story and digging up a little more, and I hope someone else does the stage production of Capote and brings up another side of it, you know. You don't leave wondering. You leave, I really feel, satiated with our slice of the pie, whereas Capote gave us their slice of the pie and you were fulfilled there. You'll be fully fulfilled with ours.
Infamous has a star-studded cast that includes Sigourney Weaver, Isabella Rossellini, Peter Bogdanovich, Jeff Daniels, and the song stylings of Gwyneth Paltrow. Out gay actor John Benjamin Hickey is Truman Capote's boyfriend, Jack Dumphy. Lee Pace, best known for playing Calpurnia Adams in Soldier's Girl, is Dick Hickok, one of the killers. And the other killer, Perry Smith, is played by the new 007, Daniel Craig, who not only exchanges a hot kiss with Capote, but manages a jailhouse serenade.
There's a gold mine in the sky far away. We will find it, you and I, some sweet day.
After In Cold Blood, Truman Capote never completed another book. It's believed that the process of writing it destroyed him. It's a hypothesis recounted in several biographies, and now, two films.
It's hard to imagine what it must have been like.
Actor Toby Jones.
There are those beautiful pictures of him as a sort of boy man, you know, around about 18, 19, 20. And I think it was, if you like, the journey that he went on between that and the sort of leery, lurching figure that he became at the end that led Doug to try and find what was the turning point. How did that brilliant, confident boy become this sort of parody of himself and bitchy, dissolute queen at the end? And I think that Doug locates it to a sort of intimacy that got under the Capote shell, and that Doug thinks happened in that prison cell. And I think without that intimacy, it's hard to explain, you know, it's hard to understand how such a brilliant man could have fallen apart so dramatically.
This has been a conversation with Douglas McGrath, Toby Jones, and Sandra Bullock. Infamous is being released in the U.S. by Warner Independent Pictures. You can find more info at infamousmovie.com and prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Love flew in from my window. I was so happy then. But after love, it stayed a little while. Love flew out. You gave me days of sunshine.
Here at KPFT, your vote matters most. Now here's a word from one of our candidates.
Hi, I'm Bob Sanborn, or Dr. Bob, as many of you know me. Yes, I'm running for the board here at KPFT. Why? Because service is something I care about dearly, and I care about non-commercial radio. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a longtime activist and advocate for children and education here in Houston. Currently, I'm the CEO of Children at Risk, a nonprofit advocacy group. Previously, I spent many years at Rice University as the Associate Dean for Student Affairs. And also previously, I served as the Dean of Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. I grew up in Puerto Rico, but Houston is my home and where I make a difference. I hope that you will help me make a difference and vote in the KPFT elections. I'm Bob Sanborn, and thank you for your support. Peace.
This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston. Here at KPFT, your vote matters most. Now here's a word from one of our candidates.
This is Thomas Williams. I come to you today as our basic liberties are being attacked. The media in this country has failed to serve the public, instead focusing on serving corporate interests, right in step with the current administration. It is a time where we must stand up and defend our liberties. Freedom of speech is at center stage and must be upheld. KPFT is a valuable asset to us. We need to increase awareness and active participation in the station. As a member of the local station board, I'll actively work to protect this resource, exerting my continuous efforts to expand the listener base by actively working with underrepresented communities, working to develop new and innovative fundraising activities, and ensure that the programming is responsive to the diverse needs of the Houston region. I ask you, please support democracy and vote in the upcoming elections. A vote with KPFT is a vote for freedom. This is Thomas Williams, and I thank you for your time.
This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
This is Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and tonight's show will feature some excellent big band and jazz music, and also some very out music by a Philadelphia artist I much respect. And I've got very candid interviews to go along with both of these segments. The Philadelphia artist is Steve Cohen, and his music has given our culture lyrically gay music that can touch you, hit home, and even make you laugh. But before we get to Steve, I'm very pleased to explore some jazz and big band music with an excellent tour guide, Ellen Seeling. Now, I've known about her work for quite some time because she and her partner, Gene Feinberg, performing as a band called Deuce, released two excellent jazz fusion recordings. And her background goes much deeper than that, as you'll soon hear. But she got my attention again with a new CD. It's called Montclair Women's Big Band, Ellen Seeling Director. And the big band classic that opened the show, called Brownsville Express, also opened that recording. I asked Ellen to tell me about the new album.
Well, this is our first recording. The band was formed in 98, and we recorded in 03, and it was released in 05. So we've been together for a while. This recording was produced by four of us, actually. Me, my partner, Gene Feinberg, who is also my assistant director and tenor player, Barbara Price, our business manager, and Leslie Ann Jones, who is the studio manager at Skywalker Sound here in California, Marin County. And it features 14 classics, including five vocals. The singers on the album are Vicki Randall of the Tonight Show Band, Linda Tillery of the Cultural Heritage Choir, and local Bay Area chanteuse Pamela Rose. It's, I like to think the album swings really hard, and it features some excellent Bay Area soloists. We're very proud of it. We've gotten good response so far, and I don't know when the next one will be, but hopefully we can get some mileage out of this one yet.
I'm going to continue this part of the interview with music in the background by Deuce, starting with a track from their 1986 self-titled release. The song is my favorite from that album and is called Texas Pearl. Did you get your start in music?
Oh boy, well, my dad was a trumpet player, although, you know, I never heard him play. He quit playing when he got married. He tried making a living on, the Midwest, I guess what they used to call tenor band circuit back in the 50s, right after World War II. And I think he told me once he never made enough money to actually buy food and get all of his shirts cleaned on time. So he just sort of gave it up. But he had a great record collection and loved music. And we always had really pretty hip jazz recordings around the house, especially for 1950. My dad had, you know, Count Basie and Duke Ellington and all the big bands. But also we had Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and some stuff like that. And so I think I was just exposed to it at a young age. And then when it came time to play, you know, in school, which was kind of late for me because my little school didn't really have a band until I got to seventh grade, which was quite late, actually. Anyway, I wanted to play the drums, and my folks said, no, we can't handle listening to that down the basement all day long. So then I wanted to play the violin, and there was no string program in the school, so that was the end of that. So trumpet was really my third choice. I just sort of loved the sound of it.
You've played on the recordings of many, many artists. For the information of my listeners, could you mention a few of those?
Okay, off the top of my head. Well, let's see. I went to New York initially to play with one of the first all-women's rock bands signed to a large indie label, and that was
the band ISIS in 1974. And from there, I picked up Laura Nero's sort of comeback gig in 75, which produced an album called Season of Life. And it was a band album, and Gene and I were the horn section for that. And we toured with Laura for about a year and did a live album, and it was wonderful. And then right after that, we both got snagged to be the horn section for Chic. And we did an album with them called Say Chic, which included their biggest hit, I think, called The Freak. And they also produced a recording for the group called Sister Sledge right after that, which that group had a huge hit called Dear Family. And Gene and I are the horn section on that album. After that, I did a whole bunch of salsa recordings, but probably the one that people might recognize is the one called Larry Harlow Presents Latin Fever, which was one of the first recorded, or I think the first recorded women's salsa band in the United States on Fania Records. And then after that, I did a string of women's music recordings. I've recorded with Margie Adams, with Holly Near. And then Gene and I sort of got the bug to put our own thing together. So I think in 1980, we put our fusion band together called Zeus, and we've released two recordings to date of that group, which was original fusion, for lack of a better word. It wasn't, it wasn't heavily rock and roll as much as it was more like instrumental pop. And our last recording was in 96. And we that's sort of been on hold for a while. We were a little disappointed with the lack of reaction we got not from the press, but really from radio stations, which I don't think radio stations have been playing much fusion for the last 15 years or so. So that was kind of disappointing. And at that time, we decided to put together the big band. So Barbara Price, who produced the Michigan Women's Music Festival for years and now owns the Montclair Women's Club in Oakland, and I put our heads together. And Gene, of course, was involved as my assistant director. We put together the big band in 98, and it's, you know, a big band is so much work. It's pretty much been all I've been able to do in terms of band for the last almost 10 years. Although I'm on the faculty of the Jazz School, which has been up and running now for about 10 years, and is based in Berkeley. And I'm very involved with the Jazz School also. So those two things keep me really busy.
That's like real stream of consciousness. You covered most of my questions.
Oh, sorry.
But I have to go back and ask what it was like performing with and playing with ISIS.
That was one of the high points of my life. I don't know how else to say it. I left college. Actually, they sort of hired me sight unseen on Howard Johnson's recommendation. Howard Johnson is a fairly well-known instrumentalist in New York City. He's still around. He's Nedra Johnson's father, I believe.
Yes.
Anyway, Howard and Carol McDonald, who was the lead singer, were sort of used to hang together, and ISIS was looking for a trumpet player. So Carol hired me sight unseen and flew me down to New Orleans to join the band to do a recording, and that's how I met everybody. And I guess it was the second ISIS recording for Buddha Records, produced by Alan Toussaint in New Orleans. So, I mean, I was still in college, you know, so this was, like, very heady stuff for me. And it was a wild bunch of women, let me tell you. It was 1975, I think. But I loved it. It was a wild time. It was a wonderful time. I had a lot of fun. I still have a lot of friends from that band. And it made a huge difference in my playing because it just totally took me out of the whole academia thing and opened up possibilities of playing other kinds of music and playing the horn in a different way. If I hadn't done that gig, I don't think I would play like I play today.
I want to share with you just a bit of the band ISIS, which featured both Ellen Seeling and Gene Feinberg. From the 1975 album, Ain't No Backin' Up Now, here's Bobby and Maria.
Maria was a lady, they knew they had love.
following ISIS, here's some more Deuce with a song called The Whole Enchilada from their 1996 album, Windjammer. About the band Deuce. The focus of the band was women, but it was a mixed band, and I read that that was deliberate.
Well, yes, it was deliberate because when you limit your personnel, and really in any way, that's exactly what you do. You limit your personnel. You know what I mean? So we wanted to have it be representative of the women players who were out there who we felt were really, really good players. But we didn't want to, for example, have a band where there were only maybe one or two drummers in town that could do the gig, and if they couldn't make it, we'd have to use another woman who wasn't up to the level of the rest of the players in the band. And it was pretty much as simple as that. There's a lot more depth now in terms of rhythm section players. In terms of women rhythm section players, I mean, we're talking 30 years ago, 25 years ago. And I think in New York at the time, there was one or maybe two drummers that we even thought, women drummers that we thought could play the music the way we wanted to hear it played. Maybe, I don't think there were any bass players or guitar players back then. So, sort of by design, you know, we wanted to have a strong women's presence in the band, and not just Gene and I, but because it was a 7-piece band for a while. We wanted mostly for the music to sound good, and since it was all original music, we were real, protective of its performance.
I have a Hot Wire magazine article about U2 from 1985, and Gene was quoted as saying, "Besides wanting to have the best musicians backing you up, that a second reason for having a mixed band was that if you have an all-female band, the emphasis is on that and not on the music." Has your thinking changed about that?
I would say my thinking has matured around that. And I should also say that even way back then, when we did women's music festivals, which we did frequently, we would put together a women's band. And we did that for many years so that we could play at Michigan and other places. And we loved that too, you know. But for our regular band at a regular venue, it was always mixed. And I think when we put the big band together, my thinking, which was, I don't know, almost 10 years ago now, and definitely about 15 or 20 years after that article, I started to think like I got really tired of looking at the festivals here in California. We had moved from New York to California in 1989. And I'm looking at, you know, the San Francisco Jazz Festival and, you know, all the big local festivals, all the big clubs, and seeing all the jazz trades come out all the time in magazines. No pictures of women, no recordings by women, no headliners, you know, no groups led by women instrumentalists. The singers, okay. And I just got so tired of it. I felt like, you know, that quote from Network, "We're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore." And I just figured that the way to really get people's attention, at least out here, was to put together a slamming women's big band and just try to work it and try to record it and be in everybody's face as much as possible. So that's what I've been trying to do with the big band. I think that with Deuce, you know, people weren't paying a whole lot of attention no matter what gender we were. I think part of the problem was the fusion thing. And I also think that for jazz purists, they really sort of resent the rock and roll influence. They don't like it. It's very threatening. And in addition to that, I think having a fusion pan led by two women horn players is very, I don't want to say unladylike, but you know how fusion is sort of like biker jazz, you know, it's sort of a tattoo kind of jazz, not really legit. And we couldn't get any jazzers to pay any attention to us at all. I mean, we didn't really belong anywhere.
Deuce had two albums which were 10 years apart. How were they different?
The first recording, how do I want to say this? The first recording included some vocals on the advice of a number of record companies, actually. And we learned after spending a lot of time and money doing that, that record companies will tell you one thing and then do something else. And that's exactly what happened to us. And I still have, you know, letters from Clive Davis and people like that saying, well, we really love it, but we don't really know how we would market it. So on the second recording, which was considerably later, we also aimed for airplay, but by that time there was the smooth jazz movement and the Quiet Storm whole thing and broadcast architecture and all of that, and we were trying to fit in their format, and it was sort of our last shot to get airplay and to get signed by a label that was going to support us so that we could tour with, you know, a band, which is really difficult to do financially. So we did an album that we thought was going to get that kind of airplay, and we still didn't get it. You know, we found out sort of after the fact that broadcast architecture is not interested in any sort of music that has brass leads or tenor leads. They're looking for guitar and soprano saxophone. But also, you know, when one person is picking the programming for hundreds and hundreds of stations, really, you're sort of at their mercy.
From Deuce, we go to the Montclair Women's Big Band and River's Invitation. Montclair Women's Big Band came from?
We're based at the Montclair Women's Club in Oakland. Montclair is a part of Oakland, and it's a small village. And Barbara Price, who is my business partner, owns the Montclair Women's Club. We wanted a band that would have a name that people could recognize. They would know right away that it was a big band, a classic jazz big band of women. So it just sort of came together.
Of course, the focus of my programming is on GLBT music, so I have to ask, are all the band members lesbian?
No, but we have a very healthy representation.
Do the classics do very well? Caravan, String of Pearls? I would think they would.
They do. One of the things I tried to do with the album is that have classics, including big band classics, like other tunes are not necessarily known as big band tunes. The two you mentioned are definitely big band classics, but that arrangement of Caravan in particular, I completely reworked. So we opened it up for solos, we played it much faster than the arrangement is intended to be played. We changed up the bass line and we added some drums. So even though they're classics, they've been kind of reworked, not totally rearranged, but we've done them in our own style. We've definitely put our imprint on them.
there an overall message you hope your music gets across?
Message. Well, I just hope that when people listen to it, they hear a band, that they don't hear a collection of players, but they hear a band that's been together, that enjoys playing together, that has a real sense of camaraderie, and that the music mostly hits a groove, and that the soloists have something to say.
Hi, this is Steve Cohen, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Now to my very special interview with Steve Cohen. I've been a big fan of Steve's work since his debut album, Silent Too Long, was released in 1997. And when I'm considering the openly gay albums of our history, I consider that one an essential album. We need to hear some of his music before we start the interview. So from the Silent Too Long album, I ask him to describe a very bitter song that has a dash of humor to it. Please tell me about I Want Everything.
It kind of evolved because most of the songs for that group were ballads. And Jack Vicari, who was my music teacher and also became the producer for the disc, he said, you got to have some fast songs. In terms of what it meant, I don't think the lyrics were, you know, specifically trying to say anything that important. It even kind of turned into a joke by the end of it. You know, give me the kitchen sink.
Autobiographical.
I think in some ways everybody has that experience, right?
Or at least have felt that way.
Right.
Shirt I bought you. You were quite a sight. I was just surprised to see you holding hands with another man. Now you come on home. Wall to wall smiles. Tell me you love me. Baby, put that bite mark there. No, you won't hide it. With that guilty stare walking around my hometown, putting it down, you hurt me badly. Now I'm angry. Before you go out the door, we're gonna settle the score. Give me the house, give me the ring. I want everything, everything,
should sink. I want everything. I've got tired of waiting on you, my dear. I want everything.
How did you get your start in music?
I bought a piano when I was 16 because I wanted to be able to perform and sing songs. I was already writing songs on paper and singing them, but I had no way of delivering them.
Did your family encourage that?
Half and half, because I wanted to play the drums from the time I, you know, can remember. So I didn't end up getting drums. So when I was 16, I kind of took the bull by the horns and said, I'm not going to drive. I'm going to take the money that I was going to use for insurance, and I'll buy a piano. So I can't say my family fought, but they didn't buy me a piano either.
When did you start performing then?
I would say probably within 2 years. I started performing out with the gentleman who taught me to play piano, basically. Put together a little band and played in clubs in Philly doing original rock.
Who were your musical influences?
Elton John would have to be one of the biggest. Bruce Springsteen.
Did it ever bother you to be compared to someone? A lot of artists want their own sound.
I think it's inevitable. You know, the people, you know, try to figure out what is it that it sounds like. So, no. I mean, the only time I would be disturbed was if somebody named somebody who, you know, either they hated or I guess as long as they like the artist, I'm happy.
Your lyrics are very out of the closet. Was that a conscious decision?
Yes. You know, especially during the first release, Silent Too Long, I was of this mindset that, you know, if I didn't say what I thought, I would never say it. Because I figured the pressures of just trying to be commercial would, you know, force me to be a little more careful with what I might say. So it seemed like the time to do it.
Looking back, do you think it was?
I'll say I have no regrets, but I am at the same time curious. You know, if I would have approached my music in a different way, might have I've been more commercially successful.
Has having such out lyrics caused you any problems?
I don't think so. I mean, I was very generous with giving out my CDs because I was very curious just what did people think of my music and what I had to say. And I would give it to everybody, you know, even the manager at the, you know, rent-a-car place, and then come back and say, what did you think? And sometimes people have said, you know, it's a bit much for me. The lyrics were a bit too heavy. But, you know, I'm surprised. Even, like, younger kids, for some reason, seem to really like it. People say, oh, I was playing it for my 8-year-old or my 10-year-old. They love your music.
What song gets the biggest audience reaction?
People seem to want to hear Dyke's Lumber. And I Think I've Fallen in Love with a Lesbian, and I Want to Be a Jock. It seems like the funny novelty songs are what people like.
Yeah, I can see that. I wouldn't call them novelty, but they do have a sense of humor about them.
Yeah, what is it that makes it a song a novelty song?
I think trying to be funny, maybe.
Okay. Because when I wrote I Want to Be a Jock, I was in high school. You know, it was serious. But then when I played it, you know, 10 years later, it was funny.
Well, I Want to Be a Jock does have the element of truth to it. It's not just telling a joke.
Right.
Where a song like Rubber Ducky, a novelty song, is pointless.
Uh-huh. I have that album.
Was the hit of the album, I Want to Be a Jock?
I believe so. If I was to do like a greatest hits album, although it's a little early for that, you know, I would probably pick out the funniest song from each. And I think that's what would make it up. But it's the one I'm most apt to play for somebody if I was going to play a song off that disc. It's the most user-friendly.
Yeah, it sure is.
Sneakers, not just to drive in. I want to wear an Adidas sweatsuit, not just to sleep in. I want to be a job. I want to strength to lift heavy weight, stare at myself in the mirror. My shirt off. It's 50 degree weather, so that my friends could say that guy fought it all together.
In 2000, Steve released his second album called I Must Have Been Crazy, and from it, I asked him to tell us about the song Your Kind of Love.
It was inspired after the Matthew Shepard incident. I was invited to play at an event in Matthew Shepard's honor, and his mother was to be there. And I know that she heard the song, and she said that she thought that it was a good song, but she didn't want to hear it because it was just too graphic. And I can understand that.
Yeah, kind of love.
walk again, but I can hear him scream. Touch him now, he can't feel a thing. Is what you kind of love supposed to bring? Hit him now, won't take away their pain. Won't talk again, I can hear him scream. Touch him now, he can't feel a thing. Is what you kind of love supposed to bring?
From Crazy, tell me about Dykes Lumber.
I was with Dave Downing and his sister hanging out after some event in New York. And we were sitting around joking about this place called Dykes Lumber. There actually is a Dykes Lumber, or I think there's a group of them, but I know there's at least one in Hoboken. But we were joking around about how the place was probably on the inside run by a bunch of dykes. And so I just sat down and we started throwing out lyrics of what we would imagine the place to be like on the inside if, in fact, you know, it was totally overrun with lesbians.
What's the reaction to that song?
Guys like it. Lesbians like it. Straight guys like it. Again, it would have to be the hit.
Cross from New York Way, in that town, you know the name. In Hoboken, on a jog, I came upon their catalog. You got need, pick up the phone, get an addition for your home. I see you smiling cause you know the number. Dykes Lumber. If you're a man feeling bored, you ain't prepared for what's in store. These women that don't need you, they got their own damn caulking and their own damn tools. If you're a woman with a serious stare, get ready for a half-price sale. With the right attitude, take the cashier home with you. Dykes Lumber. Dykes Lumber.
After I bought Steve's first album, I became an avid fan and wanted everything I could get by him. Fortunately, around that time, and partially as a way to raise funds for the next album, he made available several collections of his early demos and live shows, some of these on cassette tapes. They contain many songs that, while perhaps not quite studio recordings, that I think are well worthy of my sharing them with you.
I want to ask about a handful of songs from, I guess, your earlier releases or almost releases. I don't know how do you think of those discs?
My pre-release releases.
Okay, pre-release releases. I think they contain some very fine work. Tell me about Mr. Wilson.
That song, I think, was one of the first that had a nice little rhythm to it. And I think just the story came to mind of, you know, what it must be like to be an older gay man. You know, what must the experience be like, and how a lot of times younger gay men are, I guess, discouraged from socializing. You know, especially, you know, years ago, an old gay single man was probably ostracized by the community.
I very much like that you did that, because that is a subject matter that you don't hear about. And I can easily look back, you know, years before I thought of coming out of the closet, knowing about someone in the community, maybe older, who was gay, but being petrified to ever think of actually talking to that person.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of a homophobic response that, you know, we get somehow pushed into us, and it's hard to even be conscious of it.
There was an old man that down my road in a stone house all alone, and all the children, we stayed away in fear. Nobody could name Mr. Wilson with the fading green eyes. What do you feel inside? We don't mean you any harm. Did you grow up in a town like me? Past destiny, and the rumors, are they true? There's a once a man who shared that house for you. Mr. Wilson, you don't have to lie. You're a product of your times. I need to talk to you. Somewhere somebody didn't want you to talk to me, as if a man who's true to himself could somehow hurt me. I want you to know that we can be free. Well, Mr. Wilson told me you were insane. I can't accept that name, and I need to talk to you. Mister. Can you open the door? Open it up. Could you open it up? I know you want to talk to me.
Tell me about Record Land.
I think that was just asking the whole question as I was getting into recording of, do I want to speak and say whatever I want and end up not going at it from a commercial standpoint, or do I just want to, you know, try to hook up with a recording studio and get a contract and go on tour and, you know, do what I'm told. And I know I was kind of at my, like, wit's end when I wrote that. I think I wasn't sure what was happening with the recording deal, and I just tried to sit down and write something honest.
I know one artist who told me that putting something very, very gay on his first album was very freeing to him, because then he didn't have to worry about that question anymore.
I think a lot of it has to do with, as an artist, whether you're doing it to be an artist or whether you're doing it to try to make a living. And I think I never answered that question. I think I was expecting to make a living and say whatever I wanted to say. And they don't typically go hand in hand.
I once had a dream. Sing for large crowds. They'd understand my words. And life wouldn't be so hard. And all the love I swore I didn't need, give it back to those who accept me. But I stuck my head in the sand.
gay boys in record land. I stuck my head in the sand. I needed a deal where airplay makes you big and makes you real. You could pass me that joint so I wouldn't think and I wouldn't feel. I couldn't love me. Now strike up the band. The show must go on. It's record land. Now strike up the band. The show must go on. It's record land. He don't want to know. He pays good money to see you put on a show. For large crowds, they'd understand my words and life wouldn't be so hard.
Any questions I should have asked you?
That's a great question. Nothing comes to mind now.
I try to ask that because some artists have parts of them that they want people to know, or things that they're very interested in that people never ask about.
Right. The only thing that I... that seems would wrap things up for me a little better, I think, is it costs money to put out CDs, and I wish I had more of it, because if I did, I would have been releasing a lot more music. So, I mean, my first disc, I think, was in 97, and I went bankrupt, you know, recording, and the second disc I just paid for with another bankruptcy. So, you know, I think the pressures of selling CDs at some point do make me think about, you know, what is it that I'm doing and how much do I have to give? And what's the point? You know, in some ways it's kind of the universe says we don't want that.
But there are people I think you really reach.
I hope so. And that's why, you know, I did it at a point in my life that I could afford to do it. And I don't regret that it was done. But I do think my style will continue to evolve and hopefully become more upbeat as the years move on. Because there's plenty of good things about being gay.
or just living that, you know, are helpful to be reminded about as well.
I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening. And I especially want to thank Ellen Seeling and Steve Cohen for the wonderful and very candid interviews. And, as I expected, the interviews were so good that I could not fit all of them into the radio version of the show. So my internet listeners can hear an extended version with more comments and additional music. That, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. There were many more songs from Steve albums that I love and wish I had time to share with you. But I'm going to end this segment with one of my favorite songs from the first album, the title track from Silent Too Long. Please tell me about the song Silent Too Long.
Silent Too Long. I guess it just seemed like an anthem, a good anthem. I know at that time I was playing at gay pride events, and I was going to out music open mics in New York, and I was starting my own out music group in Philly, and I don't know if it's hard for me to imagine singing it because it's been a long time. In some ways, it's hard not to feel like my songs, the lyrics are corny.
I think they're honest.
I do appreciate that. I just know, even listening to the new Elton John disc that just came out, there's a couple lines that are so honest that they sometimes seem corny. It's hard to be to be the artist and be the audience at the same time. That's pretty deep, isn't it?
I'm not sure corny is the word. Maybe too general, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I guess corny was a bit harsh. I shouldn't be so harsh. But yes, it is hard to find a lot of places where you could perform that song and it would click. Very limited audience.
Well, I think I disagree, but let's hear the song. Here's Silent Too Long by Steve Cohen.
Land of the brave, home of the free. Why did you make a liar out of me? My country, mine to serve. This kind of treatment nobody deserves. I've been silent. I've been silent. I've been silent too long. I never said a word. Nothing was heard. And at the church, they oppressed me. In confession, I just couldn't be free. While the preachers led their double lies. Oh yes, I kept it all inside. I've been silent. I've been silent. I've been silent too long. Not a word was heard from me. But that's not how it's gonna be. And my nephew at his high school, where denial is the do what is right.
inside of me. I was his own worst enemy. I've been silent too long. If I'm gonna die to keep you free, first I'm gonna stand up for me. I've been silent too long. But God came to me one day, said, speak up, son.
Listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
It's the Progressive Double Feature, Thursday, October 26th, 7 p.m. at the River Oaks Theater. Veterans for Peace, 51 Capitals March, Verified Vote Coalition, and the Harris County Green Party present Ground Truth, the real story of the experience on the ground in Iraq, where the Lancet now estimates 655,000 have died, and Stealing America Vote by Vote. That's right, you probably already guessed. They stole the 2004 election, too. After the films, Kip Humphrey, creator of the 51 Capitals March in 2004, who appears in Stealing America, and James G. Pierre, head of election protection in Harris County, Texas in 2004, will lead discussion. So come to the Progressive Double Feature at the historic River Oaks Theater, Thursday, October 26th, and see Ground Truth and Stealing America Vote by Vote. $10 donation. KPFT, Houston.
Here at KPFT, your vote matters most. Now here's a word from one of our candidates.
Hello, listeners. My name is Wesley Bethune, and I wish to serve you on the LSB. In real estate, it's all about location. And in media, it's all about timing. Music overwhelmingly occupies drive time, and progressive voices are relegated to less desirable times. I believe that more parity between the music interests and the news and issues interests will help KPFT have a stronger voice and get stronger.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.